E. Ethelbert Miller has been described as an aesthetic entrepreneur, a man who promotes and encourages the artists of Afro-American and Third World communities in this country. An activist and community organizer, he's the director of Howard University's Afro-American Resource Center, an organization with which he's been associated for the past 16 years. Ethelbert Miller is a poet, with 5 volumes to his credit and another on the way. And in another incarnation, he's a familiar voice as a book reviewer and commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Susan McInnes. Today on Conversations, we'll spend an hour with visiting writer E. Ethelbert Miller. I understand that growing up in the Bronx, you were more baseball player, or ball player anyway, than a poet or political activist.
Yeah, I was, a diehard New York Yankee fan before Steinbrenner purchased the club. And I guess when I was growing up, that was the thing that, you know, during the course of my day, I spent a lot of time playing baseball. One thing when I look back that I wish I had never, never done is give away my baseball card collection. I had an outstanding baseball card collection that, you know, just one day I just gave away. When I look at how people are, you know, searching for some of these cards and the price and just the value of the collections now, I really feel I would have had a really outstanding baseball collection. But baseball is still very, very important to me. And I think as an artist, sports as a metaphor is one that I tend to plug into, you know, quite a bit in my work.
Is there anything, or what should I say, about the Bronx prepared you for the path you eventually took?
Oh, nothing. In fact, nothing prepared me to become a writer. And if one goes back to the Bronx today, one's wonders how I ever got out. I grew up in a neighborhood. I grew up in the South Bronx. I grew up in an area that was primarily African-American and Puerto Rican. I grew up in a housing project, which when we moved into the housing project, you know, my mother and father felt they were moving into the middle class. So that was a major step. You know, I remember when we moved from, you know, like one of the tenement houses. We moved at night with shopping carts. You know, my mother didn't want the neighbors to know that we were moving into the projects. And that was a major step. And I was in a family, a West Indian family, where education was something that, you know, was emphasized. Even though my mother and father had no college education, I was the first person, the only person to go to college in my family. And it wasn't until like the last minute that my mother and father said, "Okay, we're gonna let you go to college." And basically, what they did is that they gave the 3 of us, my brother, my sister, myself, a chance to do whatever we wanted to do. We had one choice. We made it. They would support it.
And you stuck with it.
Right. But if, for example, and they warned us, if, for example, you change your mind, you came back, like, say, 2 years later, you say, "Well, this is not what, you know, you want to do," then you're on your own. Okay. So for my brother decided he wanted to go in the monastery when he reached, you know, the age of leaving the house. And he went in the monastery, and that was a major thing, occurrence in our family, because, and I didn't realize that until, you know, later on, that what it meant was like my mother and father giving up their oldest son. And I really didn't realize what that meant for the family at that time because I was young. But my brother consequently changed his mind and came out of the monastery and wanted to go to college. And my mother and father didn't support him, you know, so my brother had to really try to go on his own and, you know, really never graduated. My sister, you know, she wanted to become a nurse, so my mother put her through nursing school. And then for me, you know, I wanted to leave New York, and I was able to go to Howard University.
We're talking with Ethelbert Miller, a poet. We'll learn more about him and his other incarnations as the hour goes along. Howard University was the turning point.
Howard University was the turning point. You know, I had never went, like, say, south, and Howard University being in Washington, D.C. is south of New York. I had never really knew about the tradition of African-American schools. You know, I wasn't like some of my friends who mother and father went to Fisk or Hampton or Tuskegee. So African-American schools were something I didn't know about. And I remember my first like couple of days on the campus. I had never seen Grits. I had no sense of Motown. You know, when I grew up in the Bronx, I grew up in a Black and Puerto Rican neighborhood, but high school was spent in a predominantly Jewish and Italian high school. And at that time, you know, the music that was coming into the school was Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, you know. And I was around a number of Jewish Americans who were like sneaking out of the Bronx to go down to Greenwich Village, you know. So we were progressive, you know, listening to Dylan's Memphis Blues and stuff like that. But what happened is that, you know, going to Howard was just a whole world opened up. And for me, I was fortunate, especially in my first year, to have a number of teachers who exposed me to African-American literature, exposed me to creative writing. And I think if I didn't have those teachers, I probably would have did something that many people who go to those schools do, and that's become a lawyer. You know, in fact, that's what my mother and father sent me down there to become. And when I told my mother that I wanted to become a writer, like I think in my junior year, oh, that was a thing that was real controversy, because there was, you know, it was like they were wasting their money in terms of sending me to school.
You couldn't support yourself.
Right. And keep in mind that when we deal with education for many African-American families, it means social, you know, mobility. It means a move up. So that means that, you know, a mother and father want their son or daughter to earn more, you know, or else, you know, why did you go to school? And to have a person say, okay, I want to become involved in the arts. I want to be a dancer or a singer or a writer. That's like, well, how's the rent going to be paid? You know, and you don't really get the support. And this is why it's so important now, especially among minority families, you know, that it's important for parents to really, you know, permit their children to look into the arts, you know, and stick with them. And if they fail, it's not as if it's the end of their lives, you know, but at least they were given an opportunity to maybe be on the stage, to write plays. Everybody doesn't need to be a banker, a lawyer, or have an MBA. And I think that once we're able to understand that within our community, then I think what happens, we'll wind up producing better artists because they will have the support before they leave home. And I think that's, like, for example, what I'm doing now, is trying to encourage my daughter's artistic ability. You know, she draws very well. She's 8 years old. And I think that, you know, I look at the support I'm trying to give her. I never received that from my mother and father.
There's in a shaky economy, it's probably nerve-wracking for parents to be able to let a child loose.
Sure. You know, but I think what we're talking about is the quality of a child's life, you know. You can't put dollar signs next to that. You can't think about, you know, whether I can afford, you know, my daughter to color. You know, you have to realize how important it is to that child and support that, you know. And then this is where it gets into being a parent. And I look at this point at my mother and father, the sacrifices that parents have to make. And I look at African-American community where parents, you know, make tremendous contributions and sacrifices for their daughter to go to medical school, you know, because, you know, then they can tell their neighbors, well, my daughter or is a doctor or so-and-so. And they make that sacrifice. And I think they have to make the same sacrifice and support to say, well, hey, you know, my daughter is opening in this play, you know, and or their book just came out. And feel that is just as important as a medical degree on a wall.
You're listening to Conversations. This is E. Ethelbert Miller. He is, as he's been indicating, a promoter of artists in the African-American community in America. On writing, your first book of poetry had this opening to it. An indication of a good writer is not entirely dependent on his usage of words or even his selection of themes. It's primarily rooted in his capacity to feel and his ability to reach the deepest levels of his sensitivity. Can you expand on that? Is that still true for you?
Well, I think so. You know, I think that feeling is very important to me. I think that when I started out writing and of coming of age as a writer, it was a time in terms of it was a considerable amount of turmoil within our society. People were expressing their feelings quite openly. And I felt that, you know, behind the rage and things of that sort, you know, one really had to bring a sense of conscience to why one was writing. And in this sense, you know, I tried to very early try to establish some criteria for myself.
This book, Andromeda, was published in 1974, Ethelbert Miller's first book by Shiva Publications. That same year, a second book, The Land of Smiles and the Land of No Smiles. Is that a self-published
book? That was a self-published book, and that was actually one long poem. Mm-hmm. Well, not that long, but it was a long poem in terms of when I started out writing in the late 60s and early 70s, almost all of my poems were very, very short. I could read all my work in like 10 or 15 minutes, and I think perhaps the whole thing of giving poetry readings forced me to stand, you know, in front of people a little longer, so I started writing longer poems. But The Land of Smiles, Land of No Smile is actually an outgrowth of a trip I took to Tanzania. I was fortunate to attend the Sixth Pan-African Conference in Tanzania and sort of use that as that journey as the backdrop for writing this long poem, you know, that deals with going from one part of the world to the next.
In that poem, you write that neither Africa nor the West provide a home for the new black civilization. Africa is a dim, mm-hmm. growing more vague recollection. Mm-hmm. The West has no context. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to ask you again, is that still true for you?
Well, I think that what you find there, you know, if somebody was, you know, doing, you know, analysis, one would take this particular poem and definitely, you know, draw a link between the statements that W.B. Du Bois made in Souls of Black Folk, where he outlines the whole thing of the double consciousness, the African-American being torn between, you know, two worlds, being either here, you know, in terms of African completely, or, you know, fully accepted by the West. I think that's one of the things that has affected African-American culture. I think that's a thing that almost every African-American wrestles with, you know. I think of people who, you know, hey, Martha, we're going to move into a good neighborhood, you know. And so they move into a predominantly white neighborhood, but they went greens, you know. It's a question of, you know, how they can get them. And you look at a point where, to some extent, some people have taken the position that I'll just create myself, you know, anew, you know, I won't be this, I won't be that, I'll be something completely new. I'll decide who I am. And so I think that, you know, the poem addresses that in that particular context. And I think that that theme that's outlined in my second book is one that one can trace not only through African American literature, but also through African American politics and social and political thought.
In the 1960s, The greatest urge, it seems, was to just create a self independent of white America.
Well, I don't know. I think in the 1960s, the issue would be to what extent American society was willing to accept the presence of African Americans in terms of equality. When we look, for example, at what the Civil Rights Movement meant, it meant pretty much African Americans be given their full constitutional rights. You know, just basically enforcing the Constitution and the law. Which had been, you know, denied. I think as the movement moves from the South to the North, what we begin to see is a definite shift that even Martin Luther King was aware of, is that we're dealing with some basic economic problems and inequality. We're dealing with poverty. How do we correct that? So in that sense, you know, this is the demands that many African Americans began to make. Even if we look at radical organizations like the Black Panther Party that began to emerge in the late 1960s, the Black Panther Party emerged basically from following the police around in California in terms of, you know, reading, making sure that people were arrested and not hit upside their head. And all they were pretty much doing was saying, okay, this is the law. We want you to enforce the law. And if you look at the one of those old Black Panther newspapers and look at their like 10-point program that was always printed on the back. Well, that's basically reformist policies. It's not revolutionary. They're not calling for the overthrow of the government. They're calling for the government to carry out what's in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we look at the 60s, you know, we have to look at it in terms of African-American people, oppressed people, demanding what is rightfully theirs.
And the writing of that period was creating and recreating
the writing itself. The writing of that period does a number of things. Writing that period reinforces the Black consciousness movement. It makes people proud and uplifting, that things are possible. It's a celebratory work. Some people have felt that the rage and the anger that the work was anti-white. The work was not anti-white. The work was pro-black. So in that sense, the whole issue of around aesthetics was one that people were constantly fighting with. who has the right to define African-American culture, who has the right to determine, you know, what's a good poem or a bad poem. And the key thing out of an entire period is twofold. One, that the African-American artists that emerged in that period produced functional work. You know, it was work for that time. You know, some of the poems were read at rally, were raising people's consciousness. So people like Ryan Karanger emphasized the importance of art being functional. And at the same time, the work was also, in its own funny little label, revolutionary. In that sense, it tried to change a society. And when we look at how it changed, we see that one of the things which comes through the work is a very Eastern flavor. You know, one could now do a study tracing the Islamic influence of the late 1960s. And when we look at people who were very prominent at that time, you take someone like Malcolm X. Well, Malcolm X does not only represent black nationalism, Malcolm X does not also represent black pride and power. He also represents Islam. He also represents an alternative in terms of another way of life. And he opens up the door to the East. And when you look at the whole development and the rapid rise, which is still continuing, of Islam in our society, it can be traced to Malcolm X and the decision that he made in his life. And that's also there in a lot of the art. You know, you look at many of the paintings and you see a little star and crescent in some of the painting of that period. You look at some of the writers who became Muslim, like Sonia Sanchez, Esquie Muhammad Ture. These are noted African-American poets. You look at the musicians of that time, and they were making references to Islam, or they were wearing funny little hats on their heads, you know, as the critics would say. And, you know, this was part of that period, which was a very, very exciting period, I think, to come through, and a period that changed American art.
There's another thing operating in that period was the challenge of English. Challenging English to reflect a new way of thinking.
Oh yeah, I think that what you find coming out of some of the issues, and it gets into the question of aesthetics, gets into the question of power. The whole issue of Black English rose up in terms of one of how people speak. You know, the sound of language there, and you had a lot of concern in terms of whether it was valid. And some people were trying to dismiss it. And in the process of dismissing the language, sometimes you look up or you're dismissing the people who speak it. So all this, I think, you saw as a power or a struggle for power that manifests itself, you know, within the field of education, within the field of who controls curriculum, you know, got into the whole thing of teaching methodology. You know, if, for example, we're saying, well, we're having problems teaching, you know, African-American youngsters. Well, somebody said, well, because you're not speaking their language. Well, that was a debate, mm-hmm. You know, and it's still there. And it's one that is very, very difficult to determine. Also what happened, people had difficulty defining what Black English was. You know, Black English was not, you know, the using of profanity and things of that sort, but Black English had certain nuances and things of that sort. And you really could see it when you begin to study like the Seacoast Islands, the Gullah area off South Carolina, and really begin to look at the fact that there are specific Black dialects, you know, that, you know, you have to look at. And how people talk and communicate is completely different. It's not standard English, you know, and it takes language to understand exactly what's going on. But it's that's another era that we're still dealing with that now. I mean, that hasn't gone away.
In writing on that period, one of the things I've noticed is, again, about English, is that a reference that says the writers blended the intellectual with street people, blended the intellectual with street language, and also brought the church life out into the street.
Sure, well, you know. See, I think, you know, what you could look at is, one, we can either sit here and give the African American artists all the credit, or we can give the masses of people, you know, the masses of people make history. The energy of the Black arts movement and the Black power period comes from the street. What you find with many of the artists that emerged from that time, some of them emerged from the street. Some of them, at least in their early years, were reading, you know, at bars on the street corners and things of that sort. I used to take the position in the 1970s that what happened is most of those people moved into the colleges, their work changed, and they moved away from the street and, you know, and got tenure. But, you know, initially they were on the street, and their work captured the language. It captured the intensity of what was going on, and it was very direct. You know, it was work that you didn't have to break down in terms of metaphor and similes. You knew what the writers were saying. It was work that either tried to engage itself musically in terms of many writers try to capture the sounds of, like, the saxophone, John Coltrane. Some people began to experiment with the blues in their work. Also, Nikki Giovanni, you know, was performing with a gospel choir. All these type of people were actively out involved in terms of making the literature accessible. But at the same time, the people were creating the literature. The people were creating literature. And you see, when you look in another art form, the visual artists, you know, when you go back to 1960, people were really heavy into murals. And, you know, you would walk down the streets and you would see these images. And that was there. The people were there. Some of the churches at that time, you know, brought, you know, African-American artists in to create the Black Christ, you know, because the churches were changing. And so in that sense, the energy, you know, was there in the community. I think what you find today is a searching for that energy, you know, because there's a freshness to it. It's a very ethical and moral energy that periodically has to rise if we're going to see change in our society. It has to come.
This is Conversations. We're listening to E. Ethelbert Miller. He's a graduate of Howard University in 1972 with a B.A. in African American Studies. He now works as the director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University. He's been there since 1974. It's a center that houses and promotes the extensive collection of Black and Third World writing in Washington, D.C. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. Toti Cade Bambura has described the 80s as a time, I have to paraphrase, she says, are you aware that the times are changing? Are you aware that we are in flux and transition? She goes on to describe what I sense to be a tougher, more volatile period of life.
Yeah, you know, Toni Cade makes a very interesting statement, I think, in the Salt Eaters, her, I guess we'll call it, experimental novel. And it's a very fascinating statement, which sort of says that in the last quarter, anything can happen. And in that sense, you know, she's talking about the last quarter of a basketball game, football game. And in this case, you know, we're talking about our century. And I always was fascinated by that because, you know, we discussed at the beginning of the show, you know, I have a strong interest in sports. And when we look at what has happened in Europe and Southern Africa, you know, Toni Cade Bambura is this prophecy. I mean, the type of change that have occurred in, like, say, this last quarter are changes that people couldn't even foresee, you know. And I think that this is a time, well, it's an exciting time. I think that it's, I would wish some of the excitement would spill over to the United States. It seems that people are saying, like, the place to be is Germany or the place to be is Southern Africa. And, you know, this is what we used to have, like, in the 1960s. And I felt that even though our society was being pulled in different ways, it was healthy. You know, you could go out into the streets and you would be engaged in dialogue, and people were concerned about what was happening in Vietnam. They were concerned about what was happening down south and in our cities. And today what you find is that when you go out, you know, some people feel very helpless, you know, like, well, what are we going to do about the homeless, you know, and, you know, and unemployment and this and that, you know, and what's going on in the Persian Gulf? I don't understand. We're Saudi Arabia. I don't understand it. And, you know, what happens now is that, you know, our society is not engaged. And I think, you know, we have to look at our colleges, you know, we're our intellectuals, you know, who sometimes can frame or should be involved in our debate. We have to look at our artists, you know, what are they doing at this time? Do they wait for something to happen? Saying who, you know, once again, who they find. And I'm waiting to see, you know, how the masses of people will respond within this country. Will respond, you know, if, for example, war breaks out in the Middle East, how do we respond? You know, right now the media is trying to figure out, well, is there an anti-war movement? You know, what's going on, okay? We have to speculate as to what would happen if a draft came back. Would that radicalize a new generation? You know, the way, for example, Virginia Beach radicalized a whole segment of African-American youth. You know, perhaps someone would, you know, come along and look at Virginia Beach, and then look at the student takeover that we had at Howard University in protest of Atwater being on the Board of Trustees. Because Virginia Beach was a baptism for a whole generation that, you know, even if their mothers and father, you know, was in Selma, you know, they didn't face the fire hoses, you know. Many of them went to private schools, you know, and all of a sudden they're in Virginia Beach and, you know, I have to move, and, you know, and they're getting clubbed aside their head. Well, what happens to a generation that all of a sudden now there's a draft? Where, okay, here it is, you want to get married, you want to do this, but wait a minute, someone else, the government's saying, no, you have to go serve. And then you can ask yourself, okay, I'm willing to defend my country. And then you ask, okay, what are the issues? Okay? And then you start saying, well, what is this about? Is this about oil? Is this about, you know, national security interests? You know, I thought the Cold War was over. All these questions will affect another generation. How will they respond? And I think that's a very serious issue that many of us have to think about in terms of what's going to happen in terms of tomorrow.
It's a related question in a way. There's a new book out called Breaking Ice, an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction. Terry McMillan edited it. Penguin is publishing it in the paperback, which is out simultaneously with a hardcover. It has a preface by John Wideman in it that it's very intriguing. He says in the beginning of that, referring to black writers, since we're seen as marginal politically, economically, and culturally, African-American writers have a special, vexing state in reforming and revitalizing the American imagination. Coming off of your thoughts just a moment ago, or just from what Wideman makes you consider, what's your next thought?
I think that Wideman touches upon something which I think when we look at why does this particular author make the statement, I think we look at Wideman's life, and Wideman has been the type of African-American who has dealt with the whole thing of being on the margin in terms of being like the only black in a certain area, being a Rhodes Scholar. And in his work, you always find this sense of this marginal man who's always looking for home, always trying to come back, trying to be accepted. And I think here in the case, Wideman's moves from this individual assessment and also begin to look at the group. And the whole thing of marginality and alienation has been a dominant theme. It's also what I call the theme of the other. Mm-hmm. It's also tied in with themes like Ellison and Wright, who dealt with the whole thing of the marginal man being invisible or marginal person being invisible. And so in this sense, you know, to make this statement in front of a collection of contemporary African-American authors, you know, upholds something which, you know, we have been wrestling with all these years.
Wideman also seems to be saying that the monoculture needs a little shaking, what he describes as the monoculture, what the American media or politically produced culture that we tend to give a bumper sticker description to when we think of America.
Well, I think what we're seeing today, and we could probably link this to, you know, the statements we made about Tony K. Benbara's prophecy about the last quarter, you know, when anything can happen. I think what we find is that our entire world needs a shaking, you know, and that's what's going on. And what we have to ask ourselves is whether we'll be happy with how things begin to settle, you know. But American culture is being transformed. You know, I mean, one doesn't have to be Marshall McLuhan to realize that there's a lot of little genies out of the box. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, how are we being affected and influenced by shows like Nightline? You know, where all of a sudden it's like, you know, we have town debates about, you know, well, is apartheid wrong? I mean, the whole thing is changing. And then what does that mean for Americans, you know, in our culture, where all of a sudden, you know, you turn on the TV and here's a window, an instant window to another part of the world, and we haven't figured that out. We have not figured out the selling of things and how it is shaping our culture, and we make mistakes. We make mistakes, you know. I'm fascinated, for example, talking about American culture, a culture that embraces, say, Michael Jordan. We tied him to Wideman because Wideman has just written a piece in Esquire magazine, cover piece, on Michael Jordan. Okay, here's Michael Jordan that has been embraced by mainstream American culture. Okay, he's on the Wheaties boxes and mm-hmm. all. You know, he sits down at McDonald's and a whole table of kids look over and say, "Is that him?" Mm-hmm. And then when you go out, you hear young white kids say, "I want to be like Michael Jordan," right? They want to be like Michael Jordan. Young white kids want to be like Michael Jordan. Now, what does that mean? Let's just make a projection. This means that, say, 20 years from now, the white basketball player will be different. I can guarantee you the white basketball player will be different. They will not be taking set shots like Jerry West or Rick Barry, you know. They will be dunking, you know, because, you know, they were into this Michael Jordan. I mean, what you'll probably see from a number of white players might be back where you should have, like, Pete Maravich, you know, dribbling, Bob Cousy and guys like that, who, even when they were coming along, people looked at them like, well, you know, they're a little too fancy and this and that. Mm-hmm. But what you find is that if Michael Jordan now is accepted by the mainstream and packaged, then people will say, okay, who grow up in Iowa, buy into this image. Okay? Now, what happens is that that image is no longer African-American. Okay? See, it's no longer African-American. This is why you are not going to hear Michael Jordan say anything about Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. See? You're not going to hear Sugar Ray Leonard. You're not going to hear any of these guys. See? If they become accepted completely by American culture. Okay? And so in this sense, what happens, we have to begin to study not the presence of African-Americans in our society, but the issue of color. Okay? To what extent is color no longer important to Americans? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right? When we'll find that color may no longer be important if color is a certain distance from us. If I can turn on my TV, my colored TV, it's okay. Okay? If I can go to game and see Michael Jordan, it's okay. If I can even buy my box of Wheaties, okay? But let's look at some of the reports that have come out. Where do we find people concerned about color? Still in a certain area, housing. I don't want Michael Jordan to live next door to me. See? Housing, neighborhoods, okay? This is what Bensonhurst, Howard Beach is about, neighborhoods and turf, you know? Spike Lee gives, for example, in Do the Right Thing, an excellent thing where he confronts the oldest Italian son, the South son, then a piece of job saying, like, well, how come you all your heroes are black? You know, and like he said, no, this guy's on black, you know, like, you know, not black. And what you find here is a young white individual in this film who has African-American hair, but don't see their color. See, but Mookie and his friends who come into the pizzeria, see, oh no, he sees that color.
Uh-huh.
See,
they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
In the wrong place. See, yeah. People want to see, you know, talk about being colorblind.
Right.
Yeah, that's what's happening to American culture now.
So don't be poor around me.
Right, don't be poor.
Of another color
right,
around me.
Right,
don't. Yeah.
Right. Now, the thing that you'll begin to see, which is going to be the challenge of the future for the African American community as well as America, will become the issue of class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? As certain African Americans, you know, are accepted. Okay? What about the whole. See, you can look at that's occurring among African Americans themselves, the whole thing of class. That, okay, if you just clean yourself up, you know, you can do anything you want to do. Say that's it. Say, and you'll be accepted. And now you can point to the statistics. Say, you can say Michael Jordan, he's accepted. Say, you know, and you can go Bill Corby, see, on TV. Color's not the issue anymore. I mean, Colin Powell. You know, if there was one position I thought African Americans would never be, was not President of the United States, was national security advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Say, and the thing that has enabled me to stay abreast in terms of making predictions is the fact of something that person who I really admire, Walter Rodney, who was a Pan-Africanist and historian, he gave a speech before he passed away, before he was assassinated in Guyana, and he was analyzing third world politics, and he made a beautiful analysis about why you were beginning to see these changes in third world countries and, you know, leaders, and I applied it to the United States. And when somebody said, well, you think Jesse Jackson could be president of the United States? I said, yeah, Jesse Jackson could be president of the United States. You know why? Because it's a black man's job now. And you say, and somebody said, how can you say the president of the United States is a black man's job? And I said, and this was a couple of years ago, I said, look who's president now, Ronald Reagan. I said, Ronald Reagan's president of the United States. Ronald Reagan's changed the standards. John Reagan's changed the standards. See, you know, so now any kid, the myth, you grow up and be president, that's right, you can grow up to be president, okay? Then what happens, what do we see happening? The presidency is a ceremonial job. You look at some of the books that have come out under Reagan years. You know, I mean, people say Ronald Reagan was going to sleep. He took naps and things of that sort. You know, and basically what was his strength was the fact that when it came down to delivering and selling the product, communicating, that's when he shined. Okay, if it's based on communication, Jesse Jackson should be president of the United States. Right? We saw that during the debates in the last election. Jesse Jackson, the most presidential. You know, when he brought Goodman back from, you know, from the Middle East, and he stood in that Rose Garden, he looked presidential. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt, you know, for example, during the Carter administration, when people were upset that, well, how can Jimmy Carter name Andy Young to be ambassador to the UN? I said, because Andy Young looks good in his suits. He looks like an ambassador. You know what I mean? And so what happened, when we look at what's happening in our society, see, we're just more concerned with these images and packaging, we will see that African Americans will play a key role in the packaging. The key role in the packaging, because of our color, we transmit well, okay? And that's and see, we got to ask ourselves, to what extent is it just the image, see? Because you're going to have a number of important African Americans who are going to be in key places. Are they just images, see? Or what happens when they begin to think as a person of color? See, then you have a national security issue. See? It's like saying, all of a sudden, Colin Powell thinks that, well, I'm an African-American. The Saudi Arabians, you know, the Saudis here, they're dark like me. The Iraqis, you know, some of them are darkest. You know, how is he thinking? See? I mean, all of a sudden, and that's a very tricky issue. See? A very tricky issue that you never know how a person might respond as a person of color. See? Especially if you're in a society that's saying color's no longer important, it's no longer important, no longer important. But then all of a sudden you say it is. See, I was reading a recent thing which was fascinating. Somebody said, I think, that Ronald Reagan's father was alcoholic. And that perhaps Reagan during his entire life, as like coming out of a member of a family that deals with alcoholism as a problem, went through a whole thing of denial. So, you know, you always look at things as being optimistic. Now, you know, I mean, that's an analysis. But, you know, you have to think about things like that. But I think the whole issues of color and class, when we start thinking about the mainstream culture, these are things I think are going to be very fascinating, you know, to study and to examine. And it's fascinating. That's why I majored in African American Studies.
Let me reintroduce you to our listeners. This is E. Ethelbert Miller. He is a visiting writer at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. He is an executive board member of the Pan American Center, vice president of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. He also directs and organizes Ascension Poetry Reading Series, the oldest literary series in Washington, D.C. You were talking about America perpetuating its image, and that image has become all important, and that as long as we don't speak of the uncomfortable things, or as long as we don't speak outside that language of comfort, we are fine. Who in your mind, or we are fine, we are welcome within the embrace of the society, all of us, who in your mind is not speaking that comfortable language?
Well, I think a number of people are not speaking the comfortable language. You know, Louis Farrakhan's not speaking the comfortable language.
That's clearly.
Some of the rap groups are not speaking the comfortable language.
John Weidman brought up that rap emerged of necessity because so many black artists were being embraced by the music industry, and so the outlet for the African American community was kind of disappearing as it got co-opted into America at large, and rap groups had to come and say, "Hey, all's not gorgeous with the world."
No, I would disagree with that. I think that when we deal with like rap. Let's look at New York City. You know, let's look at the South Bronx. Let's look at what's happening in that area. New York. I mean, you don't have to be a sociologist to say that here's a real gem. You know, in terms of what's happening in terms of culture. You know, I see a real breakdown in terms of values and things within New York City. To me, New York City reminds me of one of those like medieval towns and stuff like that, you know, where like, well, maybe if we can overthrow the king, everything will be all right. You know, then you get rid of couch and you realize, no, you're still a peasant and serf, you know, and your life doesn't change. But, you know, the knights around, you know, they're having a good time. But, you know, what happened when I look at that, I look at the community which gave rise to rap, and I look at what was happening to that culture, see, because that's not America. saying, you know, that's not all America. I mean, you've got people out in the Midwest, they're still dressing in plaids and, you know, wearing penny loafers and stuff like that, you know. I mean, so what we're seeing in terms of with the media and stuff is how quickly various forms of culture can be distributed nationally. But keep in mind that is not America, okay? That's not all of African America. You know, I mean, African Americans is very, very diverse. And what we have now is the whole thing of packaging of culture. And see, this is why you find certain areas of resistance in America. People don't want to hear that rap stuff. They don't want to hear that. And within the African American community, some people are concerned about letting some of those tapes, you know, come into the house and be played. You know, I mean, some of those tapes that I couldn't take that and play that to my mother. Mm-hmm. You know, which is not to say that I don't think that it's not valid, because I think we have to ask ourselves, okay, where is it coming from, you know, and how languages change, you know. And see, this is where you get into issues of class. People may not want to talk about it, but when you take the African-American community, there's a segment within the African-American community that just talks in such a way that four-letter words, I mean, that's it, you know. I mean, that is part of the vernacular. You know, and so in that sense, it's not even profanity anymore. You know, and if we look at what's happening in American culture, we can see just in terms of language how that's changing. You know, the Bart Simpson character. You know, I mean, you know, who the hell are you? I mean, you know, he would have got his mouth washed up in 1955. You know, and saying things like "damn" and stuff like, can you say that on this radio? Stuff like that. You know, would really, really be bad. But I think that when we look at what Wyman is saying. And we say that, you know, this music had to come out, it had to be born. We have to look at where it's coming out of, okay? It's coming out of a specific place, and then it's being projected across the country. The same way, you know, we have to ask ourselves, okay, what is the roots of reggae? You know, we see reggae being a combination of West Indians listening to Otis Redding and James Brown and mixing it on up into their own thing. I mean, you know, but it's coming out of certain conditions. You know, Bob Marley comes out of certain conditions, and then, you know, the music can become international. But when we make when we do analysis, we can't begin our analysis based on where something is currently. We have to go back to its beginnings, look at the conditions. I'm saying that if you want to understand rap, you better understand New York City. Mm-hmm. You got to understand New York City. You got to understand the whole hip-hop culture. You got to understand the whole role of the DJs and the scratching of records and all, and what that is about. Also, you've got to understand graffiti. See, what happens is the visual equivalent to like what was like rap and things of that sort, the visual equivalent was graffiti. You know, the break. Remember breakdancing? Well, that was almost the dancing
physical.
Of right, the
yeah.
physical aspect. Yeah. But you know, you've got to put that in the context of New York City, and you've got to study that, and then you've got to understand how American culture, the dynamics of American culture, and to understand that, we have to understand American history, and then we begin to understand why there's things like civil wars. We begin to understand the frontier, okay. And why people resist. You know how people used to talk about the East? You know, fighting the East? And what was that about? And if you came out to Wyoming and you had a Boston accent, you know why that was a problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think today, when we look at our culture, we're still having that same... America is not homogeneous. It is not. And see, what happens now, we have new values in which we're saying we don't even want to be homogeneous anymore. See, we want to... What we're emphasizing now... around is diversity, okay, ethnic diversity, you know, and that's a whole new agenda, okay. Jesse Jackson running around talking about American quilt is completely different from Monahan, somebody talking about a melting pot, completely different things, okay. How is that going to change, you know, our analysis of our country as we move into the next century? I mean, this is going to be the challenge of our intellectuals. This is going to be the challenge that every parent will be confronted in terms of how to raise their kid, you know, our foundations or, you know, everything, you know, and it's filled with a lot of question marks and fears, you know, because the whole thing of identity is mm-hmm. what's at stake. And I remember, it's in one of Marshall McLuhan's books, might be the Global Village book, in which he deals with this whole question of identity. And that when people lose their identity or feel they are losing their identity, they have a tendency of becoming violent. And they realize that to reclaim their identity, you know, violence becomes a process. And that's what we're seeing happening in certain pockets within our society. And if we use New York as an example, so just use New York as a microcosm of perhaps some of the problems that we might face in this country, then you see exactly the conflict between Italians and African Americans and Koreans, okay? Well, if for example, we have problems with those groups living together, say, then what's going to happen as the rest of the country, say, you know, have more Asian Americans, you know, more people moving? So because we're moving into certain areas now that are developing. You know, you might look up and all these problems are coming to like Washington State and well, like Portland, Oregon, places like that, having some of the problems as new ethnic groups arrive. You know, so all of a sudden somebody is beating up an Ethiopian, you know, in Oregon, you know, and these are the problems of the future.
I'm going to switch tracks on you for just a moment. The emergence of black women writers in the 80s and into the 90s seems to have had an impact on American readership as a whole. Has their influenced in particular Afro-American male writers from your perspective?
I think so. I know they really affected me in terms of you know, my consciousness. I've just felt that, first of all, when we look at the African-American women writers, you know, 70s and 80s, and we single them out, we're talking like Toni Morrison, we're talking about like June Jordan, Alice Walker. They happen to be, at that time, the finest writers writing, you know. I felt that, you know, Song of Solomon at that time, you know, by Toni Morrison, I just couldn't, you know, I'll name names. I didn't think that people like Dr. O. Miller and others were writing better than Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. You know, Toni Morrison was the best writer out there, you know, and that was just a fact. You know, then we had Alice Walker and, you know, some of the others. And so in that sense, you know, these women writers, I think, moved to the forefront because they were the best writers, you know. There was nothing happening in American literature, you know. There was really, I mean, we really can't point. For example, we dealt with, in terms of race, who is the major white writer in the United States? Who's the major white writer? You know, well, maybe somebody might say Dr. Rowe, you know. And, you know, you look at Dr. Rowe's books, you say, well, Ragtime's nice, Book of Daniel's nice. You know, I like Billy Bathgate. You know, but, you know, I like Song of Solomon, I like Beloved, and I'll give him a run for his money, you know. But when we go back to the 70s and 80s, the women writers emerged because, you know, the times call for them to emerge. You know, I always look at the social conditions before I look at the literature. You have a women's movement. You have women writers coming to the forefront. They have something to say, you know. And for the tradition, it was being said. It just was not being acknowledged, you know. As the scholars come along and the critics come along, you know, they give us back, you know, our Zora Neale Hurston's. They give us back our Jesse Fawcett's, our Nella Larson's. You know, they give us back our Mae Miller's, you know, and our Alice Dunbar Nelson. And you see that these women were always there. You know, some of them were the wives of famous men, you know. So, I mean, somebody probably will go back and hopefully rediscover, you know, Sterling Graham Du Bois, you know, and Eslanda Robeson. These were great women who were making these contributions. And I think that when you look at the 70s and 80s, you know, women came to the forefront because in our society, women were making tremendous social gains. Also, in terms of just the politics of literature, women were beginning to make significant gains within the publishing industry. You know, and I think that one thing that African American women did within the civil rights movement is radicalize on white women. And you look up, and some of these women eventually were active in the publishing and were sensitive to the voices and writings of African American women and were very supportive. I think that if we look at a publication that has to be given some credit for helping promote African American women writers, we have to give Ms. Magazine a lot of credit. You know, Gloria Steinem, you know, Alice Walker was a contributing editor. June Jordan, many of her essays appeared in there. Michelle Wallace got placed on the front page of Ms. Magazine and launched her book with Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman. So in that sense, there's a magazine that really opened the door, you know, for women writers. But the key thing was that we look at what was happening in our society and we realize that the women come to the forefront because the movement is there, you know. But I also say, because it sometimes gets overlooked, these writers happen to be the best writers at that time. Now, when we look today, I would say, you know, quite clearly that the best writer, and at least best American writer, white or black, I would say is August Wilson. You know, and I think August Wilson is transforming American theater. And we look at the impact that theater can have. And this is why Wilson is making some really important decisions right now. His ability and willingness not to let his work appear on the screen, okay, unless it appears the way he wants it, is really, really holding on to it. Because he knows exactly, you know, you put fences on the screen and everybody who couldn't get to see them in Broadway and things of that sort, it's going to rush out, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, if it's not done right, you know, it'll hurt his work, you know. But I think that Wilson is definitely, you know, a very, very important writer. I think Weidman is yet to be heard from. I mean, he's got a number of wonderful things, but you can still see when you read his work, like he's groping for something. He's groping for something. And I think that maybe the next book, Philadelphia Fire, was not it, you know. But I think here's a man who's prolific, and I think that that it's coming. Charles Johnson, I think, you know, should get his due. That's what, to me, Charles Johnson should get his due. And hopefully the award that he recently won will encourage people to go back and read, you know, like Faith in the Good Thing, which I think is I felt when I read Faith in the Good Thing, and I read that book when everybody was talking about Toni Morrison. And I felt that what happened is there were a number of African-American writers, I sound like Ismael Reed now, that did get overlooked by the attention that was given to African-American women writers. And the reason why they got overlooked was that whenever an African-American woman writer emerged, there was a context for her. You know, she was placed like, oh, here is Zora Neale Hurston's sister, or here is a woman in the tradition of Toni Morrison. And you would be an African-American man, you come out with a book, and like, well, there was a book, you know? And so in that sense, there was no context for her. And then the key thing is that when women's literature came out, we had some very important women's journals to promote the literature, women's studies programs across the country, and an audience of people hungry for the material, you know. And so in that sense, what happens if you're Clarence Major, you know, doing experimental stuff and writing your novels, well, really, your books come out, the infrastructure is not there, the review journals, you're not going to get on a talk show. Because what happened, people realize not only is your book important, but you're reflective of the gains that women are making in society. Or perhaps your story is also giving us a clue of what is happening in our society. So that's why we want you to come on to this talk show, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. And that promotes your literature, that promotes your story. And this is the reason why what will be very important for literary scholars to do, and if we don't do it, we create the same mistakes that people did, like, say, for example, in the 1920s, where all of a sudden everybody focused on Langston Hughes and Connie Cullen and Claude McKay and forgot about Zora Neale Hurston and Nella Larson and Mae Miller and all those folks. What would happen if we look at the 70s and 80s in which African-American women writers dominated, then we're going to miss all those male writers who had like these one books in there, you know, people like a Percival Everett or a Charles Johnson, they're gonna get lost. Clarence Major, there's a lot of guys. See, what used to happen, people would say, well, there's, you know, African American writers aren't getting published. I say, wait a minute. John A. Williams had X number of books, you know. People forget about David Bradley in the middle of there. You know, the Charles Johnson, you know. I mean, all these guys, you know, who are not household names, but are writing. And if, for example, teachers and scholars do not go back, you know, and pull these writers out and teach it, it's going to be lost. It's going to be lost. In that sense, the whole thing of making our literature in this canon holistic will not have been achieved. You know, and this is the thing where we have to look at how we label periods, you know, and how we teach our work to a new generation of young people.
One last question. You said Toni Morrison was not only ready to be a brilliant author, but also emerged out of a social condition that allowed her to burst forth, and that John Wideman is one short of his great novel. What's your prediction? Who's going to burst on the scene next, or from where? Last prediction from you.
Well, I think August Wilson will probably win another Pulitzer, and people start comparing him to Eugene O'Neill. So I think that's there. I think that Samuel Delaney, in terms of science fiction writing, has not gotten his full due in recognition. I think he's a person who is entitled at this point to some full-length conferences. You know, I think that somebody should do like a Sam Delaney conference, you know, and really give him his due. I would really like to see Octavia Butler go back and complete a project that she abandoned, because I think, you know, perhaps if she sent out some queries, the response would be different, and that is to do an anthology solely on African-American science fiction work. I think she would do that. That could be a very powerful book in terms of it would bring together African-Americans dealing with their predicament in this country from another angle. Also enable some of them to see themselves perhaps outside of not only America, but the world. So I think that's interesting. In terms of poets, I think Elizabeth Alexander, who I know is a fine writer whose work is getting, you know, wide acceptance. Essex Hemphill, who while I was here, you know, talked about in terms of African male homosexual writers. I think that, you know, his voice is important because of the conditions, because of the times. I think that as we look across the country, we need to look nationally, because what happens is that there are so many good writers in this country, African-American writers, who are in places that you wouldn't believe where they are and where they're writing. And it's a question of going out there and making sure those voices are not only encouraged, but, you know, reach a wider audience. So, you know, look for somebody, you know, this sounds like Marcus Garvey talking about look to Ethiopia, you know. I would say something like, you know, look to Wyoming, New Mexico, or Idaho, or somewhere like that for an African-American writer to emerge, you know, somebody who's just completely out. In fact, you know, when you look at it, you know, the next strong wave will come from the diaspora. You know, that's where it will come. It will come in terms of maybe somebody who's translated, from Brazil, you know, a person of color. Some of the major writers right now in terms of black would be people like Edward Brathwaite from Barbados, Derek Walcock, who's in this country. But I think Derek Walcock has to be on at least somebody's list for a Nobel Prize in Literature. You know, so that's real. Then you've got such an exciting scene of writers in England, you know, so that when we look into and see what's happening now, is that the dialogue is increasing. You know, I spent a lot of time talking to folks in England and stuff like that, and it's this dialogue now, you know, so that you can go from where you used to go from, like, Philadelphia to D.C. to Atlanta. Now you got people going, you know, to Brazil. You know, they're going to Kingston. You know, they're going to Africa. And and they're writing, you know. So you take, for example, Henry Louis Gates, who's a major critic. Okay, who's a key person that you find him close to? Wole Soyinka, Nigeria. You know, and you see that Gates supports, you know. Well, these are these contacts that are really happening with people thinking international. But, I mean, that's what's happening now in terms of one, you know, the whole global village type thing where people are consuming this stuff and they're responding to it. And what we realize now is something that James Baldwin said and was very prophetic, and that is that the world will never be white again.
Ethelbert Miller, thanks for a fascinating hour. You've been listening to Conversations. The voice you have heard predominate during this last hour is E. Ethelbert Miller, the director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University. That resource center houses and promotes an extensive collection of black and third world writing. His books of poetry, the earliest, Andromeda and the Land of Smiles and the Land of No Smiles, Migrant Worker, the next book, published in 1978 by Washington Writers Publishing House, The Season of Hunger, Cry of Rain, by Lotus Press in 82, and Where Are the Love Poems of Dictators, published in 1986. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations. Tune in again next week.